Welcome to the Savvy Dentist Podcast with Dr. Jesse Green, the show where great dentistry meets great business. Listen in each week as we bring you an inspiring person who will share their story, ideas, and business techniques to help you create a practice and a life you love. And now introducing your host, Dr. Jesse Green.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to the Savvy Dentist Podcast, the show where great dentistry meets great business. Our guest today is a social analyst with a huge international following. He's a sought-after demographer, futurist, social commentator, and he's a particularly engaged person when it comes to researching social trends and analyzing customer segments. Mark McCrindle, welcome to our podcast. Thank you so much for hanging out with us today.
Well, thanks, Jesse. An absolute delight. Good to be with you.
Demographics is obviously your stock and trade, something you guys think about all day, every day. But for those of us in small to medium enterprise, it's something we hear about, something we have perhaps an academic interest in. But what I'm really curious to dive into today is transcending the academic interest into something that's practical and useful for our audience. But before we do that, I'm curious, could you just give us a bit of a background? How did you find yourself in this line of work? It doesn't seem like something you would tick on your HSC form. How did you find your way into this work?
No, that's right. I mean, the pathway to demographer and social researcher, it's not a mainstream career pathway, but I always had an interest in people. People both in terms of who we are statistically and what defines us as a community, as a population, but also in how people make decisions and how customers or clients make decisions, what influences us, our attitudes and values, and all of that is the social research side. And so I, from school, went off to university and got a psychology degree and was actually thinking of heading into the clinical pathway there with psych, but in the end, yeah, preferred more the social psychology, transitioned therefore into this field of sociology and social trends, and started a business looking at the snapshot of communities, people, individuals through in-depth research that's sometimes interviews or focus groups, the qualitative side, and then the survey side, the quantitative side, and then obviously the demographics, another aspect of data analytics that give us information about who we are, and that's been my pathway since.
Well, it's a really fascinating pathway, and obviously you get to look at all the data, you get to assimilate all those magic data points and draw conclusions from it. There is a great saying when it comes to investing that the trend is your friend, and I suspect that's true in business as well. So you're in that very fortunate position to be able to perhaps look at trends before they actually arrive and see and predict the future to an extent and go, okay, well, we're likely to be heading down this path or that path. So I guess to ask a very straightforward question up front, what trends on a macro level do you see are going to be affecting perhaps the Australian economy and even the broader global economy over the next few years or so? What are the factors at play? What are the things that are going to be shaping what we do?
Let's look at those demographic trends firstly, because I think the demographics give us the richest data. And as you say, you know, it's not just looking at data alone, but looking at the patterns in the data, looking longitudinally at which way all of that data is headed. Because while the future is uncertain for everyone, we can triangulate on the future, if you like, by looking at the trends of today. We can extrapolate forward and get a real sense as to where things are going. So if we look at the demographic trends in Australia at the moment, we've got massive growth of our population, which provides great opportunities. The 2006 census showed us we'd just hit the 20 million mark nationally. Here we are today, more than 25 million. So we've increased our population by more than a quarter in a little over a decade. That's significant growth. And most of the growth actually is in the urban areas. So we're becoming more densified, more urbanized. Our capital cities really are driving the growth and driving it through different ways of living. It's not just the suburbs and detached homes anymore. It's more apartment living. It's the vertical communities, not just the horizontal ones. Cities like Sydney passed the 5 million mark a couple of years ago. Melbourne's just got to 5 million last month. So pretty significantly sized cities in Australia. Brisbane, one of our fastest growing cities, getting ever closer to 2.5 million, Perth's at 2 million. So I think understanding the growth is key. Understanding the drivers of growth is important. And apart from natural increase, and we do have record population births at the moment in Australia, and we're living longer, but even bigger than the births minus deaths is the net migration. So that's 2/3 of our growth. So we're more culturally diverse than ever. And probably a third key factor that defines demographic trends at the moment is the aging cycle on which we find ourselves. And so in the 2011 census, our average age was 37. The most recent census data shows the midpoint in our population is 38. And some states, like Tasmania, it's 42, or South Australia, it's 40. So we are getting older as a nation, really, because we're living longer, and that provides opportunities and challenges as well.
Yeah, it's a really great snapshot demographically. Thank you for that. And I'm curious just to understand, and again, we'll look at something a little broader than Australia as well, because we do have people listening in from overseas. But one of the things I'm curious just to tap down on is population growth, which here in Australia has been a pretty hot topic in the news of recent times. There's the big Australia conversation that we talk about, should we, shouldn't we, blah, blah, blah. And I'm sure there are pros and cons either way. But you mentioned the urbanisation of the cities, that most of the population growth through, whether it be through births or in migration, seems to be still in those major metro areas. What's happening in the more regional areas at the moment? In the work that I do, I see, I suppose, anecdotal evidence of a bit of a population growth there. Is that actually happening, or is it not backed up by the data?
It is happening in those larger regional centres, the regional cities, there is strong growth. So you take an area like Geelong, for example, it's actually the fastest growing city in Australia at the moment, even outpacing Melbourne, which is numerically the fastest growing, but in percentage terms, Geelong growing by 2.7% per annum. Australia grew by 1.6% in the last year. So it shows the strength of some of our regional areas. You've got cities, even inland cities like Ballarat and Bendigo, that are growing very strongly. Albury Wodonga is growing strongly. Toowoomba up in Queensland has got some strong growth. So if we think about regional Australia, you've got the large regional centres or cities, both coastal and inland, cities of 50 or 60,000 people plus that are growing very strongly. And then you've got the outer regional cities or towns that are smaller than that, which have not been seeing as much growth. And so we sometimes hear about the decline of some of the regional parts of Australia. That's more the smaller towns rather than those large regional centres. And keep in mind, the Gold Coast is considered a regional city, as is Newcastle, and each of those are 500,000 or more in terms of population. The Sunshine Coast, fast growing, Wollongong, fast growing as well. So yeah, it's not as though we're talking regions and we mean these towns of 20,000 people. A lot of them have hundreds of thousands, and that's what gives them the scale, and the lifestyle experience in some of those regions is really a city living experience, as you'd find even in some of the capitals.
Yeah, it's an interesting thing, because you think of Sydney or Melbourne or Brisbane and you think, okay, major amounts of infrastructure, major amounts of lifestyle amenity, major amounts of everything. So what is it that then drives the growth to those regional centres, the larger regional centres, the Ballarats, the Bendigos, the Albury Wodongas? What are the drivers behind that? Is it people not being able to afford the major metro areas and looking further afield, or is it people genuinely wanting to move to those regions? I'm just curious to understand what drives that growth.
Well, the first factor you've tapped into is pretty clearly affordability, and the cost of living, particularly the cost of housing in some of these regional centres, is way below that of the nearby capital. And, you know, again, those capitals may just be an hour or so away. That's true of the Central Coast or Wollongong from Sydney. It's true of Ballarat and Bendigo and Geelong from Melbourne. And so, and then obviously Southeast Queensland from Brisbane, you can go Gold Coast, Sunshine Coast or Toowoomba all in an hour or so. And yet the house price there is way less. The availability of homes, particularly those that maybe don't want the apartment living, they're looking more for the house and land package. That's where the growth is, the affordability is. But additionally, it's lifestyle. And so people are making the change because, yes, they can maybe get a more achievable mortgage or maybe sell where they are in a capital and have nothing much left on the mortgage. But the commute time to work is going to decrease. The stress that they're feeling, maybe they can drop to one income or one and a half incomes instead of the manic busyness of parents juggling work and kids and commute and traffic and all of that. So the lifestyle appeal is strong. And a third factor is that they're not giving up in terms of much opportunity. You know, people in the past were headed to the cities because, you know, the regions maybe didn't have the schooling options or the university campuses or the jobs market. Well, all of that has changed. And assuming it's a large regional city that has good employment opportunities. And in a lot of these large regions, there's actually some skills shortages. They're looking for the workers to come in. But you've got, I mean, they're cities. So you've got all of the retail options, the cafe culture, the urban amenity people might look for, as well as giving up some of the negatives of the larger cities in terms of congestion, cost, and transit time. So, you know, there's a real sense of win-win as people make these transitions from the big cities to those regional ones.
Yeah, it's an interesting conversation because, again, Mark, your work is so diverse and so rich that there's a lot of threads that I could pull on to try and unravel and see where we go. But I am curious to ask the question whether the manic busyness is a factor that is showing up in the research in a great deal, because quality of life, people working, you know, really, really hard, mum and dad working, kids at school, that sort of stuff. Is that a thing, really? I mean, are people wanting to say, you know what, I just don't want that for my life? Because if I go back to my parents' time, I'm in my 40s now. I remember my mother worked part-time. Everything was relatively manageable on 1.5 incomes, or, you know, 1.3 even. But these days, that doesn't seem to be quite so achievable in the metro area. So are people getting jaded by that, and are they wanting to kind of go back to a simpler life, or is that just a small portion of the population? Again, I'm trying to get a sense of scale.
Yes. No, it's true right across Australia. I mean, particularly in our big, expensive, congested capital cities, because you've not only got the work there and the requirement for that work, and often overtime, you know, just to pay the bills and the rent or the cost of living, but you've got the increased commute time. And so it does create stress, particularly when those extra life stages like the family years come along, or some other community responsibilities, or the carer role as one's parents age a little. All of that creates a real challenge. And the latest census data shows us that 2 in 5 working Australians are working 40 or more hours per week. Now, if you go back to 1948, so we're talking 70 years ago, that's when the official 8-hour day, 5-day working week came into play. So we were supposed to be working at the maximum 40 hours from then on. 2 in 5 still haven't got the balance right. And by the time we add in the commute time, most people are working beyond that. In fact, this fascinating Australian Bureau of Statistics data analysis shows that the average working Australian has 4 hours leisure time per week. So after the childcare responsibilities, the domestic work, the outside of home paid work, the essential sleep and self-care activities of life, we've got 4 hours of downtime per week. And yet, if we go back to that 1948 breakthrough, the slogan at the time to get work-life balance was 8-8-8. They said, you know, ideally 8 hours sleep, 8 hours work, and 8 hours play on a daily basis. Well, we're managing 4 hours in a week. So that's the challenge that Australians are juggling.
Yeah, and why is it that it's getting busier, do you think? I mean, we can talk about house prices going up, but is that the chicken or the egg? And why is it that society just seems to be, I don't know, frantically busy, chasing endlessly?
Yeah, good point. And it's because, well, one of the key reasons is because what we're looking for, what our standard has become, the basic standard, the Aussie dream, is not just a reasonably simple home with the essentials, but something that is, well, more expensive, larger, filled with updated devices and technologies, not just one car, but two decent cars as well, upgraded every so often, and an overseas trip every couple of years with the family, you know, not just an overseas trip when we retire. So yesterday's ideals have become today's standards. Yesterday's options are now the essentials of this era. And each new generation comes along and expects that, well, they're going to start their economic life in the manner in which they've seen their parents finish their economic life. Now, that sort of living is, of course, unsustainable and is going to cause great stress because, you know, you've got increasing costs and increasing expectations and increasing lifestyle goals, and it does lead to, you know, resulting stress and cut back in that work-life balance. In fact, this other analysis we did recently, we looked at how much the average Australian sleeps, just all adults, average across men and women. And again, instead of the 8 hours that we're told, you know, really is the ideal, the average Australian spends 7 hours and 3 minutes actually in bed. It doesn't actually include sleep there, but in bed, hopefully, sleep comes pretty soon after getting into bed. But the point is that we're a little below even what that ideal is when it comes to sleep.
Yeah, so for all the good intentions of that 1948 exercise, we're further away from it now than we were perhaps then. So it's an interesting time. So, okay, so let's just talk about the demographics of age for a moment. We did talk about that. The median age is increasing. We've got that demographic bubble with the baby boomers, of course. And I wanted to ask you, as the boomers retire or die, and there's going to be a transfer of wealth, what do you see happening in that space in terms of asset prices? Is it such that there's going to be a glut of assets for sale and asset prices become deflated? Or is it going to be a smooth and orderly transition of wealth from one generation to the next?
Yeah, I think that it will be an orderly transition. I don't see a great bubble or excess or perhaps oversupply of any particular thing. Yes, the baby boomers are the largest demographic our nation has ever seen and the highest net worth generation ever. In fact, the over 55s in Australia own $3 trillion of private wealth, most of it locked up in a family home, but in superannuation and other investments as well. And just self-evidently, over the next two or so decades, most if not all of that will be either spent or passed on to the next generation. And so the question is, what's going to happen with that intergenerational wealth transfer? Firstly, I think a lot of it will be consumed by the baby boomer generation themselves because they are living longer and they have higher expectations of how that those post-working years will look. It's not the traditional pensioner attitude of lunch at the RSL on a Tuesday when it's cheap and some city excursion tickets and that sort of thing, but upgrading the cars and often downsizing from the family home, but upsizing in terms of the quality of living as they move through new properties, upgrading the cars and a bit more of the retirement services to provide a bit more of the lifestyle that they're looking for. They're not only living longer, but they're active later. They're younger longer in a sense, chronologically. And so that means that they can spend more money later. So I think much of it will go into their own years, although some of it will be passed on to their children. One of the outcomes will be that you'll end up with a further fragmentation of wealth because some children of the baby boomers, largely Gen Xers of today, will get quite an estate, a largesse. Others, we know, don't have much to pass on at all and so won't get as much. So yeah, a bit of a change to come in the Australian wealth landscape over the next couple of decades.
So, okay, if the baby boomers are going to be living longer, perhaps consuming a fair chunk of that $3 trillion that they control. And then at the other end of the spectrum, we've got, I don't even know what the name of the young, is it Generation Alpha, the youngest generation these days?
Exactly, yeah. We've moved through Generation X and Y and Z, so now it's the Alphas, the very youngest of today.
Gone all the way through. So what are we seeing at the other end of the demographic spectrum and what sort of things might the younger generation experience, even the millennials today, what might they be experiencing or expect to experience as this time marches on?
Yeah, well, I think it's certainly an era of great opportunities, and each generation is shaped in a different era, influenced by different technologies and events and experiences, and is required to adapt to it, to a changing society and world as well. So what we see with the young people today is life is not like their grandparents that we've just discussed, the baby boomers, where, you know, you could train up for a career and really stick with that throughout your life, maybe the odd job change or two. The Aussie dream of home ownership could be achieved on one full-time income and people were a bit more stable in terms of buying that forever home and largely sticking there, maybe the odd change here or there, but largely a lot more of a sequential life and life was more predictable and more structured than what we see today. The challenge for the emerging generation will be future-proofing their careers. They're moving into jobs now that didn't exist when they were still back at primary school. We hear much about Bitcoin and blockchain technology and the engineers and developers in that sort of thing or app developers or virtual reality engineers or, you know, robotics and nanotechnology. And so whole new sectors have emerged in the last decade, providing new opportunities. Traditional sectors that were the mainstay of the employment landscape are disappearing. Manufacturing, an example of that. The big declines that we're seeing in administrative and clerical type roles as computers, technology, and all of us just manage our own secretarial or technology needs. We're seeing declines in agriculture from an employment perspective as things go large scale and technological. So I think that we do need, and this generation have recognized that they need to adjust and adapt to the technology, to the emerging careers, to the global nature of our economy. They therefore will be they'll be multi-career in their outlook. We estimate that they'll have 17 separate jobs in their life across 5 separate careers. And they'll move across far more homes. We estimate that they'll have 15 different homes in which they live because they'll rent a lot more and rent later in life. And that involves a lot more mobility. So, yeah, they'll be more global and digital and visual in terms of the information they process, social in terms of who influences them, and clearly mobile in terms of where they work and live. So quite the difference from their grandparents to what we see today.
Yeah, I think that's really fascinating. There's a couple of things I'd like to touch on there. And just in terms of healthcare, where do you see the trends, especially for the next 5 to 10 years in that space? Is it a case of, as the baby boomers hang around, that you know their healthcare spend is going to go up? Do you see that putting pressure on budgets and so on? And what's that mean for the end consumer? Is it such that the end consumer is going to be doing more of their own pay as you go? Or do you think the health insurance companies are going to kind of put their finger in that pie and try and eat that up as well?
Well, firstly, from a consumer perspective, healthcare is not only a dominant focus as people age, but the expectations of what they can get there and when they'll access it continue to increase. The baby boomers have engaged with private health insurance and are prepared a little bit more for a user pay system than we've seen in the past. And they'll be hitting their older years when, you know, in the past we might have been a bit more, I guess, triaging them away from major and expensive surgeries like hip replacements and the like. But this generation will say, no, I want that. I need that mobility and I'm prepared to pay for it, or I just demand that I can access it. And so we are going to see higher costs that come from the higher expectations. And that will flow through to the emerging generations, where they will certainly be raised in an era where they will have to have the money and will expect to get the outcomes that they want. We've seen a change in attitudes through the generations where the things that once were publicly provided, whether it be roads and public transport, whether it be health or education, have increasingly become privately provided. In fact, 40% of these young students today go to non-government schools rather than the free one up the road. The majority of households with dependent children have private health insurance. And more and more we're getting on our roads and the toll beeps as we start to pay for that thing, or even private transport overtaking some public provisions from Uber to new forms of privately funded transport. So we're definitely in a changing era, and I think it provides opportunities for healthcare providers to tap into the expectations, the opportunities that this new generation presents, but understanding that they clearly are demanding consumers looking for those outcomes, prepared to pay for it where possible, but with a high expectation of the service delivery and outcome that will be provided.
So just trying to pull a couple of threads together, Mark, I guess for some people who will be listening to this podcast, they'll be going, okay, I'm already a dentist. I'm already, you know, that's my career at the moment. I may or may not choose to reskill depending on which generation they fit into there. But assuming that they're going to be a dentist for the foreseeable future, what particular advice would you have for those people listening to the show about where those opportunities lie? Is it a case of saying really take good care of the baby boomer generation? What sort of things might the younger generations be wanting in terms of healthcare as they move through, given the affordability around housing? How do these things come together, and what is it likely to look like from a healthcare provider's perspective dealing with those different cross sections?
This is where you move from the demographic analysis to the business applications, or from some of those broader social or generational trends to, hey, you know, how can I respond? And I think there are some clear lines, some dots, if you like, that we can join. I mean, from a business perspective, the dentists need to recognize that we are dealing with a digital generation. And so the marketing, the means of connection that they will have into the surgery will be through the referral of others or through the digital marketing, not just through traditional print advertising or just, well, mum and dad went here, this is my family dentist, this is the place I know. we're dealing with this mobility, as I said, where the average renter in Australia stays just 1.9 years per abode. So if we're in a high rental area and we haven't advertised or connected with our local community in the last 2 years, half of the people don't even know we exist. Half of them don't even know that we've got an operation in the area. So I think it's that sort of constant communication through the digital channels, recognizing the social influence of others and the power of that. Even some of the services that people look for, and I'm sure dentists have seen this, a shift from, of course, the necessary dental care and prevention through to the cosmetic side. You know, it's a society and a generation that doesn't just think about the health benefits in the long term, but they think about the appeal and the visual in the short term, if you like, the Instagram generation. And so the aesthetic is so important in addition to the actual healthcare and the lifestyle and indeed the well-being, not just the medical side of the outcomes. I think it's important to be able to communicate in a way that makes sense. And again, we've got a more highly educated generation in terms of more of them going to university. In fact, more than one in three millennials, Gen Ys, have a uni degree. But that doesn't mean that science and clinical evidence alone will sway them, because the recommendation of others or their own experience or perhaps even a visual or emotional appeal or anecdote might win them over. You know, they might have got something from Dr. Google that informs their perspective beyond just, you know, the clinical facts. So we've got to find new ways of communicating and giving and influencing them towards a right outcome beyond just purely those scientific facts we could put before them.
Yeah, lovely. And I think that's the absolute gold. Ladies and gentlemen, if you've just joined our conversation, I'm having a chat with Mark McCrindle from mccrindle.com.au. And Mark is a really well-known demographer, social commentator, social researcher. Mark, I wanted to just take that thread that you mentioned there about how to communicate effectively with the younger generation and so on. Is it likely, from just going back to the demographics again, from a location-based perspective, are we going to see millennials move into the regions as well, or are they already there? I'm wondering for those people who might be going, okay, this is great, I understand it from, you know, downtown Sydney, I'm living in Newtown or wherever I happen to be in inner Sydney, but if I'm out in Albury, Wodonga or Parks or somewhere else that's a fairly significant regional area, what sorts of things are likely to happen there? Is it the same sort of thing, or is it going to vary from location to location?
Yeah, there definitely are some differences in the regions compared to the cities. But again, you know, let's get our categories straight, because the cities aren't just our capital cities. They are those large regional cities. And a lot of the lifestyle, a lot of the living there is the same as it would be in a suburb of our large capitals. So there are some differences in regional Australia. I mean, particularly that there's a little bit more of a local focus. People have a bit more of an identity that I'm a Novocastrian, or, you know, here on the Gold Coast, this is how we view things, compared to the cities. Sydney and Melbourne don't have that same. They're just more culture diverse. They're global cities. People come and go. So they don't have that same strong identity as a city. They might connect a bit more in their smaller breakdowns, perhaps a suburb or an area. But apart from, you know, a few little differences, generally those large regional centres, well, you can treat them as we would in the cities in terms of connecting, engaging and marketing. All of these regional cities have a large youth population now. The average age is slightly higher than the average or median age of our capitals, but not much. And they've all got university campuses. And again, you're getting young families moving there for affordability reasons. They've got a varied job base these days. So they're providing great opportunities, and we're going to increasingly have those young families there. But one thing to keep in mind, just generally, wherever we're based with this next generation, is that if we can meet their needs, even though they're moving more frequently from home to home, that sort of thing, or vocationally, that might move them to the other part of town, they will travel. If we can meet their needs, then they're not just locally based where, well, I go to the dentist up the road because that's where I live. If they've had great service, if they're really connected, and if they find great value, not just for money, but in terms of outcomes at that provider, then even though they might move to the other side of town, they're prepared to travel that hour or whatever every so often for the service that a dentist will provide, because the trust is there, the experience is there, the knowledge is there, and they'll go back. So they are stickier if we can get the right outcomes. On the other side, just because they've been there since they were children, they're happy to move on and provide someone who meets their own needs if they find someone else. So you know, we've got to work with them and connect with them. But if we can connect and maintain that relationship, there's no reason that even if they move, they won't stick with us long term.
Yeah, fantastic. Mark, I wanted to ask you about trust. Has your research shown up anything around trust? Because I live in Canberra, so it's political by nature just by living in the place. And there seems to be an erosion of trust in public office and some public institutions. And of course, with the advent of Dr. Google and other sorts of things where people can do their own research and be more informed, how is trust changing with time?
It is changing a bit. And if we look at where there's been the trust erosion, it hasn't been that we don't so much trust people anymore. We don't trust our communities. It's largely that we don't trust the institutions. And that's been the big challenge. And that's the big institutions, from the large bureaucracies and the banks. And we've seen issues there. Some of those church denominations have suffered in the trust stakes, and even some of those big corporations as well. That's where we're a bit distrustful as a nation, because we're unsure of the agenda, of the big scale of these institutions, and people are a little bit more individualistic and feeling empowered to find their own solutions these days. But as individuals, and indeed as professionals, there still is great trust in certain quarters, and dentists enjoy amongst the highest trust that we give out in our society. Doctors or GPs do pretty well in that regard as well. Some of those other professions, and we've done some studies on the most trusted professions, have suffered a little bit, but it's good news for the dentists, because they are seen and of course are independent, client or patient focused, and up with change and trends generally speaking. That's the perception. So that's great. The other good news with trust in our studies here is that it is passed on from the generation. You see this with brands. You know, mum bought this brand of soap powder or Band-Aid, so I'm going to buy that as well, particularly young people as they start their families. Now, they might branch out and make their own decisions, but there is still an intergenerational nature to it and a transferable nature to it as well. So if I have built trust with this particular person or organization, and I refer that to people that trust me, then they will come to transfer that trust in that person as well. So again, great opportunities through that referral and through that credible social media, if we can build that in the right way, to give that great recommendation to us of others in the network.
Mark, thank you. That's wonderful. It's nice to know that dentists enjoy high levels of trust. I think we all listening to this show will go, great. Well, we try hard to engender trust and to create an environment where people feel, you know, safe. And it's obviously not always the experience that patients want to have. No one really enjoys going to the dentist per se. So it's nice to know that there's that level of trust, which is cool. What I wanted to ask about, Mark, as we begin to wrap up, I wanted to ask you about some things that our listeners should just keep an eye on, little things just to watch and be alert to as they project into the future and start thinking about their business, start thinking about their planning. What sort of things do you think dentists should remain alert to in terms of changing demographics, whether it's the growth of the population, the aging of the population, whether there's going to be any cultural overlays from immigration and so on? What sort of things do you think we need to be mindful of as we go through our journey as business owners?
Well, it's a great question, and highlights a key issue that we've seen in the last decade, which is disruption. And we've all seen where organizations haven't adapted to the changing technologies, they've been left behind. And from Kodak to Video Easy, there's lots of examples of that. So therein is a lesson for us. Can we keep on the cutting edge? Can we remain relevant through being innovative, through being responsive to the change, through being adaptive? People do place a high credibility on technology. So if the dental practice is using the latest technology, you know, if it's visible that they've got some of those innovative methods and means, if they're across some of the latest approaches and insights, that's going to give confidence to consumers who just expect every area to be innovating and to be technologically informed. A second area that I would highlight is the cultural change. And, you know, more than one in four of us was born overseas. In fact, the biggest proportion of migrants now are coming not from Europe, which was in a sense our past, but now from Asia to our north. And so there are different priorities, values, expectations, attitudes that have come from those that have been shaped on the Asian continent compared to the European one. Not only that, but even language diversity is key. We've got in cities like Sydney and Melbourne, more than one in three of residents in our two largest and most culturally diverse cities speak a language other than English in their home. So language diversity is key. And can we connect with our population in that regard and understand their key needs and expectations? And probably a third one is just the generational insights. And with new generations and new families coming through, the opportunity there is to connect with them and to deal with what are their key priorities, which is thinking about their children and their future and stability. I think connecting with them in those early years, as dentists have always done, but maintaining the connection. And I guess, like we've seen educators do, they're not just providing education for today, but they're really facilitators of the learning futures. They're showing how they have a plan, not just for this term or this year, but here is the foundation we're bringing so that this child will have this opportunity into the future. And if dentists can start to speak that language to new parents, where they highlight how they're approaching dental care, how it's not just, you know, a part of the body, but informs the overall health of them and their future as well. I think that starts to speak their language, that long-term focus, not just the particular procedure, this particular visit. That starts to, you know, build the confidence, and I think will create the place to go for that family where they will have that long-term view, you know, as generations past used to have.
Wonderful. Mark, thank you so much for your insights. So you've been incredibly generous. Your breadth and depth of knowledge around all of this and the practical application is phenomenal. I get the feeling I could talk to you for about 5 hours and only scratch the surface. It's really incredible. Mate, I really do want to say thank you. You've been incredibly generous to give up your time and talk to us today. For people who want to find out more about your work, please head across to mccrindle.com.au. Mark, again, thank you so much.
You're most welcome, Jesse. Great to be with you.
Cheers.
Thank you for listening to the Savvy Dentist podcast with Dr. Jesse Green. For more free tools and resources, join the free Facebook group. Visit drjessegreen.com/Facebook. And for more episodes, visit drjessegreen.com/savvydentist.